You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of My First Show. Today's guest is just a lovely, sweet, and frankly, very talented human being that I have made turkey sandwiches with, sang turkey lurkey time with, and am now having a podcast with. And that is Robin Lord Taylor,
Hi.
The star of the big screen, the small screen, the internet screen, all screens.
Hi. Oh my God. Hi, Eva. It's so great talking to you. I miss you so much.
I miss you too.
What an intro. My ears are burning. Jeez Louise.
Well, you know, I have watched you grow up in this industry, and that's a really special feeling. You live it, so you feel it all the time. But I imagine and I hope that you've gotten this feedback from people who've known you since your start. And I'll be honest, you have always delighted me to no end in person, and yet on the television, you have scared me to no end.
Yes.
So the
and
the
on
gamut.
The podcast, I'm gonna freak you the fuck out.
I have a feeling you might. So the gamut of roles and beings that you have also lived, both from your portrayals and who you are, also are fascinating. And because, you know, one of the things I think about with you is really your activism too, and your deep-seated beliefs in doing what's good. So as I start every episode, knowing all of that, how are you doing right now?
I'm doing all right, all things considered. You know, it's like this whole year has been, it's a new normal, and it's like, you know, it's like allowing a lot, you know, time for self-care, and also just like, you know, reconnecting with and really finding what the most important things are to me in my life, and, you know, and fostering those connections with the people who are also really important now that we also can't spend the kind of time with them as we used to. And I'm sure, you know, and also as a New Yorker, you know, and you as someone who works on, you know, on Broadway and you know, creates theater, you know, it's like, I think like we're all just collectively in this state of shock / mourning of losing that. I mean, that's why I live here. I live here for live performances. I live here for theater. I live here, like, you know, that's just such a part of being a New Yorker, especially one, like, you know, if you're like us and you live in the arts, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But all that considered, you know, like, I'm hopeful, and I'm just trying to keep a positive outlook. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, anyway. Yeah. I call it New York being not New York. And that's the complex relationship I'm having right now with my city, because I love it and it's so important to me, but it's not my city as I have lived it and known it for 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, sort of reckoning with both my desire to flee and my commitment to it. It's a complicated relationship I'm having right now.
You know, it just really is. Yeah. Well, how long have you lived in New York, if I can ask?
2000.
Oh my God, we're the same. Yeah. This is our 20th year.
It's our 20th year. It's
what
crazy.
A year, huh?
I know. What a 20. But
what
for
a 20.
Sure,
I mean, shit, yeah. Being here 20 years and then just like thinking of all the stuff we've been through in these 20 years.
Yeah. So, you know, I was actually going through some drawers recently, and I came across a little map for the Rainbow Railroad, which had been given to me by your husband at one point as a gift, because I am a big lover of Fire Island. And it was sort of in connection with that. that. And I literally came across this like 2 days ago, which is so weird. And I think it's still something active and vital that needs attention. But I'm curious if you could just sort of update me on where things are at with your work with it and how it's functioning now and everything.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. For bringing that up. Yeah. So Rainbow Railroad is an organization where, for those who don't know, it's an organization that, finds people all around the world, specifically in countries where it is illegal to be homosexual, or just illegal to be LGBTQIA+. And so this organization finds those people and helps relocate them in to safe countries, such as Canada, the United States, unfortunately, not so much in these last 4 years. but yeah, and it's just an amazing group of people, and the things that they're doing are so prescient right now, especially again with, you know, immigration and like helping people find safe places where they can live their lives freely and openly. And yes, my husband Dickie, he created On Fire Island, the Great Gay Garden Tour, in support of Rainbow Railroad. And it's a little map, and it, like, as you know, in Fire Island, you know, gardening is the thing. Like, people treat their gardens like, you know, it's an expression, and you know, it's such a beautiful place too. And so my husband and I sort of like compiled all of the prettiest gardens and like created a little tour, walking tour that people can take. And yeah. And so, you know, obviously in this last year, that kind of has changed. You know, we didn't go out to Fire Island this year, unfortunately. Yeah. But you know, we're still working with Rainbow Railroad, and Dickie's doing a lot of work with them, you know, just in terms of like, you know, helping create more, just really getting the word out, if it's on, you know, social media or other, you know, just spreading the word of Rainbow Railroad and what they're doing. It's been really fulfilling.
That's amazing. And it is, am I right? Like, you talked at the start of this conversation, you're finding other ways to fulfill yourself. You're finding a new normal for how you are being in the world. Is activism and impact work what's scratching your itch for what would normally be fulfilled by your work as an actor?
It's true. Yeah, definitely. But it's also like, it's sort of been that way. Like, you know, when you're a struggling actor, like just trying to break through, that's so much of the focus of my life. And that was the focus of my life for, you know, 14 years. And then Gotham happened, and all of a sudden it was like, it's the classic role where it broke my career right open. And then, like, you know, there's a new stage. And like, and now, like, you know, since I now have a little bit of more of a platform, like I really want to use it for what's right. And yeah, activism is, you know, especially in this last year, has been, yeah, definitely, you know, a real focus of mine. But, you know, I was actually talking to Dickie last night about this, and, you know, it seems daunting at first, but, you know, I've also realized, especially with, you know, the election coming up and, you know, all of the things that we're trying to do to help people get out the vote, and, you know, just being as active and involved as I can be, I realized, you know, I guess I realized last night we were talking, like, you know, that can never go away now. This is the new, you know what I mean? It's not like I can like suddenly get to a point and be like, okay, well, I don't have to fight as hard now. Yeah. No, in 2 years, when it's the next election cycle, it's got to be just this and more. It has to be more every single time. And again, like, that seems daunting, but, you know, I think of the alternative is like, I just don't know how I could really live with myself if I weren't like really pushing for these things as hard as I have been in this last year.
It's actually kind of incredible, because I think about other countries, and let's talk about 20 years ago when you and I first came to New York. We could vote, and we had both lived in New York when this city suffered a major trauma with 9/11, and then this country went into the Iraq War. You know, we lost our innocence. The country and the politics of our country began to change, and nothing was ever the same. Yet around the world, you had countries where the presidential elections really, really mattered because it was the difference between life and death, right? Mm-hmm. For people who were serving in the Israeli army at 18 or people who were dealing with communism falling or not falling in various countries. And you're absolutely right. It's like in the 90s, there was some version of America in which it was like Bob Dole or Bill Clinton. Are they that different? You know, how different will America be? Well, here's what we've now learned.
Yeah,
America right. will be very different from your for yourself and your children, depending on who's actually in Washington voting on laws. And the fight is now more serious than ever and will continue to be as long as we are in such a divided nation where people are coming from such different backgrounds and ethical choices. So you're right. It's like we will only be pressing down on the gas more as we get older and as we continue, because the activism is so dire and necessary in a way that I don't remember it being like that 20 years right. ago when we
absolutely.
Were kids.
I mean, and you know, yeah, we were very lucky to have that experience, not thinking about this constantly. But I think also like what we've learned like over the summer, like with Black Lives Matter and the civil rights movement of our time, is that like I've learned that my complacency directly affects people's lives and I cannot afford that anymore. And you know, like that mm-hmm. is my mission, is to never be complacent again. Because, you know, even if things are fine for me, I'm very fortunate in many ways, and you know, they're not fine for everybody.
Let's rewind.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your real beginnings. Like, we're talking pre-turkey sandwich and other things that I observed. But your first show that you ever saw, what was it? Where were you? Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, can I give a little bit of backstory with this?
Please.
I think it was 1987. And my family got their first CD player. We got our first like CD boombox player thing.
You were ahead of things if you had a CD player in 87, dude.
87. Well, yeah, you know, I feel, yeah, it was a good year. And the first, my mom went, she bought our first CDs. And I believe it was like Fleetwood Mac, Tango in the Night, both Whitney Houston, her first albums, and then it was also the Chorus Line soundtrack. And, you know, we grew up with musicals, and I guess I was 9 years old at that point. I'd seen Mary Poppins and all the, you know, whatever Disney stuff was out at that time, and also Sound of Music and Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, that was all, you know, in our house. But I had never heard an adult musical. I had never heard something that was not... You know, that was, yeah, strictly about adults and what they deal with. And at 9 years old, I put on a Chorus Line, and it fucking changed my life, because it was also, you know, it's Chorus Line. It's performers singing about why they're doing what they're doing, and singing about like growing up and childhood and, you know, like all this stuff. And it just, and also tits and ass and the whole thing, you know, like I was just like, whoa. And so, coincidentally, I spent that entire summer listening to the soundtrack. And then that winter, I believe, was the Chorus Line touring company came through Cedar Rapids. Mm-hmm. So we went to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is right by where I grew up.
That old tour stop of Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Cedar Rapids, Iowa, you know, the Paramount Theater, very, you know, beautiful old theater in downtown Cedar Rapids. And I saw it, and you know, it changed my life. Then we bought the VHS tape of the movie, which I stand by that movie. I don't care. I know people hate it, but like that movie.
I like it too. It's
so of its time. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But different, right? A little frustrating when the lyric changes from what you remember from your.
Yes. And then there's that whole other. Yeah, like in the movie, there's that surprise. Like they don't do Hello 12, Hello 13, Hello Love. Yeah. Instead, they do this like surprise, which is about like, you know, going through puberty and, you know, like it's like, I'm like,
you're like, why?
No, it was a little, yeah, jarring, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I too grew up on the sound, like learning and loving the soundtrack first, the cast album first.
Yes.
And then seeing the show and sometimes being confused by why the lyric that I had in my head from the cast album was different than what I was seeing on stage, or worse, I had my mom bought me the London cast album rather than the Broadway. And so I was, I had been listening, or the movie soundtrack, which aren't even called cast albums. So I had, so I got used to the wrong version of the show until I saw it. That was always a bit of a journey.
It's so true. Yeah. You had to be sure, like with us then, well, shortly after that, we got the Evita soundtrack and I was like, Mom, I need the Patti LuPone version. I do not want the English version. I don't like it. Oh, Patti LuPone on me.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And also the other thing too, I think, I don't know if you remember, but yeah, like, well, at least the version that we had, I think it was the original Broadway recording, except they cut like 10 minutes out of Hello 12, Hello 13, Hello Love. And so like, and I didn't know this until I guess when I saw it, but then I saw it again years later and I was like, oh my God, yeah, this song is like, five times as long as it was. I was listening to it. Yeah.
First show you were in, what was
it? My first show I was in was Cinderella, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. And I was very lucky because I was in seventh grade and I was allowed to join and be a chorus member in the high school production of Cinderella.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me.
Big deal. Granted. We're talking about Solon High School in Solon, Iowa. Public school, but my graduating class was like 75 people. So it was, you know, it's like, and it's also like Friday Night Lights. So it's not like they're not a lot of like musical theater kids like coming in there. So, and also they brought, well, so anyway, I'll say like, I played the character of like I played like a townsperson. Mm-hmm. And there's that big, like, the prince is giving a ball song, you know, where it's like mm-hmm. they're running around town and like, and then he's like listing all these names. And then, and it's in the original TV production with Leslie Ann Warren, like this little kid like pokes out and he like I forget what the character is, but he's like the town caller or he like works for the palace or whatever. And he's like listing the names and then he says Maisie. And then this kid like pokes his head out and he goes, Maisie. That was my line.
And that was you.
And that was me. You. That was me in seventh grade before puberty.
So really it was Maisie.
Yeah, it was like, Maisie.
I don't remember I don't know Cinderella that well, I don't think, but I don't remember a character Maisie that needed to be called out.
I don't remember it too well, so I don't want to like misspeak, but I did do a little research before we taped this. And I was like, I did like a YouTube search and I was like scrolling through like the whole Cinderella with Brandy and Whitney and uh-huh. Bernadette Peters. It's all on YouTube. So I was like, perfect. And so I was scrolling through, they gave that line to Bernadette. Oh. She goes, Maisie, in her like voice, you know. And I was like, where did my part go? But if you're gonna give it to Bernadette.
I mean, I'm actually flattered for you.
You
the role you embodied, where you were like stolen from the elementary school to have to do,
right,
was then repurposed for Bernadette Peters. I mean, come on.
That's it's true. Sometimes she can sound like a prepubescent boy.
She can. I mean, I think she tries to.
Do anything.
Yeah.
Could do anything.
She does for a laugh. She's very good at getting the laugh.
Yeah.
And so just drilling down to this casting, this casting success story, did someone put you up for this? Were you like hungry for roles? Like what actually brought you to the audition to get that role?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was excited about theater. Like my family, my parents were both actuaries, and so they're very smart math people, not performers. But there's a lot of music in my family, and a lot of my little sister, she was, you know, always a performer. Like it was mm-hmm. from and she, with she had a great voice. And so she, younger than I was you know, auditioning in the community theater stuff in Cedar Rapids. And so she was involved in that stuff too. And I knew that it was something that I was interested in as well. So yeah, when it, you know, when I got to junior high school, obviously nothing was like that was happening in elementary school, but in junior high, I was like, oh, I can actually be, you know, right, in productions, which was so awesome. And I've like said this, I always think of it too, like, you know, not in seventh grade, but as I did more theater throughout high school, it was always like, you know, I was closeted, and you know, like, it was sort of in a town where, you know, in the mid 90s, you know, it wasn't very acceptable. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and it's also, again, like I said before, it was like, you know, it was very sports centric, you know, town.
And you're saying you were like, you were out to yourself at that point.
I more or less, like, I kind of knew, I mean, I think I was in denial in some ways, but I pretty much knew, especially later in high school. And then I always sort of thought of it like, you know, it was a way to put myself out there, and to like sort of express myself, but also hide, you know what I mean? Like, I spent a lot of time in high school, like hiding just out of fear of my own personal safety, mm-hmm. you know? So it was like, I discovered theater as a way to express myself, but to do it where, you know, and still be hiding at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Makes a million times sense. It's actually the most clearly depicted and sensible thing I've heard in a long time. It is what theater is there for, to become something else, to get lost in, to express yourself via some character or emotional trait, or to just be around like-minded people that make you feel a little more alive. So
yeah. And you're so right. I'm so glad you said that too, because that was also just such a huge part of it, is just to have like, this is something all of my friends were into too. And, you know, it was just, I finally had like a group of friends that, you know, were intellectually challenging and like supportive and loving and expressing themselves, you know. It was just, it was really super important to me.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Did you have a role model for coming out and for the type of man that you wanted to grow up into, either as an actor or as a gay person?
I'm trying to think, like, I really didn't, not in so many ways. Like, it's not like when I was that age, I like was thinking, oh, I really want to be like this person. Because again, you know, we're talking like 1994, 95, 96, mm-hmm. like there really weren't any like mm-hmm. out, you know, gay. I mean, there were out gay people, but it wasn't as prevalent. And it was also like a much, smaller range of what being gay was, what that looked like was, you know, again, very limited back then.
Yeah.
But back then for me, it was like, I just need to get to college. I was like, get to college. And I went to Northwestern in Chicago. So it was like a big city. And I was like, once I get there, I will be able to find all of these things. And yeah. And that's where all of that really happened.
No, that makes sense. I'm not sure people
I'm not sure the general public knew Nathan Lane was gay in 94 and 95.
Yeah, I think that was a thing where, like, he unfortunately, you know, at the height of his career was, you know, in so many, I mean, he was forced to stay, you know, to be in the closet. And it's just such a different, Rosie O'Donnell, you know, it's like all those people back then had to do that. Yeah. And so it was just such a different, you know, just such a different way of looking at things than it is now. You know?
Absolutely. And thank God it's changed.
Thank God.
Yeah. First professional show.
Okay. This is like one of my favorite things to talk about. Cause I was, well, as we know, I moved to New York in 2000s and I was in a show called Schmoozy Togetherness.
Oh no.
Which was written by our friends. Sam Foreman did the lyrics and Eli Bolin did the music. And it was a children's show. It was about like 45 minutes long to an hour at Manhattan Theater Source down in the West Village, which is no longer there, I believe. And so we performed in the weekend mornings. Billy Eichner was in the cast along with other friend Diane Davis. It was just all of these Northwestern friends. It was like our first show that we did together in New York. And Kristen Schaal played the title role of Schmoozy. She played Schmoozy, and it was about a little girl who gets lost in this like land of grammar and words, like. As you know, Sam Foreman, he's such a
House of Cards, Sam Foreman.
Yes, House of Cards. Yes, he's just a genius wordsmith. Like words are his, you know, his currency. Yeah. And so it was all about that very like phantom toll booth kind of story. And I played Phineas T. Happenstance was my character's name. And it was it was fantastic. We also called it Schmoozy Hungoverness because like it was like 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, and we would all, and it was again the first year that we all moved to New York. I'll never forget, we were also performing, it was in the fall, and so like it was Halloween, and there we had like a Halloween show, and Billy Eichner walked right up to a little girl in the audience, and he had like a skull in his hand, and he goes, "Ooh," and the girl freaked out. This little girl started screaming. It was so funny. Oh my god,
I love it. The creator of the John Mulaney Sack Lunch Bunch, and a writer on House of Cards, and you know that Billy Eichner of Billy on the Street, and so many other things of fame.
Kristen Schaal.
And Robin Lord Taylor. I love. In Schmoozy Togetherness.
I mean, that was, it's one of my favorite titles too, because it was also like, I mean, that's how we were living then, you know, like we all like, you know, that's all we would do is just hang out and schmooze.
Well, I think it's time for a revival of Schmoozy Togetherness.
I'm down. And I stand by that show. That show was clever as hell. And I would like to do it a little bit later on Sunday morning, if that's possible. Like,
you were very entrepreneurial theater maker back then, because you also, another thing I watched you create was, co-create was, and star in, was Creation Nation, which was a show that you starred in with Billy Eichner, which I think parlayed to his Billy on the Street series, because it had a similar, you know, ethos of him interviewing people. So how does one become a theater entrepreneur where they can just create their own shows and make them happen?
It really helps when your best friend and roommate is a comedic genius. Like like that's how you start. So if you all, you know, that's the key. Like just find a comedic genius and force them to be your best friend and roommate and good shit will happen. It was like Billy and I were, you know, again, it was 2003, I believe, and we were living together in Chelsea, and you know, I was like knocking around. I'd done a couple commercials at that point, and I'd done some theater stuff around town, but nothing, you know, crazy. And you know, there's such so much downtime, especially when you're like trying to start a career in this business, you know, at the beginning, you know, it's just like trying anything. And Billy, it was started with Billy. Billy was just like, let's do something. Let's make something. And like, and you know, Billy has such a, you know, brilliant, but, you know, keen sense of humor. And we just sort of like, you know, that's what we did. We were like, let's put on a show. And we sort of developed these characters that were not us. They were truly honest, different characters from us.
But also not you also though.
Exactly.
Right?
It was like taking us and like exaggerating it and making it like, you know, these characters, if Robin and Billy were more less self-aware than they are and less socially conscious in some ways, you know what I mean? Sure, like it was like sure. taking like ex- like just making these characters very extreme so that we could show certain aspects of the entertainment industry specifically through these characters and their choices. Like
very Seinfeldian. And also just
Exactly. It was us, but not us at all, if that makes sense.
And I came to many a show, and
you did, and we also that was how we met. Like that was our connection.
Because we went to Edinburgh at the same time.
We had the turkey sandwiches. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, right? I mean, that trip was such a. We spent a month there, and it was such a fucking blur. Like. I just remember rain, and I remember the Madonna album Hard Candy came out, and I was just listening to Madonna and walking around in the rain for a month.
And weren't you hanging out with Joan Rivers, or is that a different trip?
Yes, that was. Joan had a show there as well, and Joan had been a guest on Creation Nation, and Joan was one of the most kind, supportive people I had ever met of that stature, you know, ever. And she was so generous to Billy. She loved Billy so much and loved his sense of humor. And she was such an advocate for him. And she like, you know, passed the videos around to people. She just, you know, she was such an amazing force in Billy and my life. at that time. And so like, yeah, she's amazing. And so, yeah, she guested on our show in Edinburgh as well as in New York a couple times. And like, she just was so fucking down to earth and cool and like, and just so kind. It surprises people when I say that, but yeah, she was really one of the kindest people in the industry. Yeah.
I've heard that from a lot of people actually.
Really amazing. And like, yeah, she just, you know, and I, you know, again, Creation Nation, Billy, Billy was the star of that show. And I was there to, you know, that was, you know, like an Ed McMahon, you know, Andy, sidekick. And so I had met like Joan a couple times just in that context. But like, yeah, so she just had such a crazy effect on me. Like I was just devastated when we lost her.
For sure. Because you had a professional sidekick like gig as well, if I'm not mistaken, on The Late Show with Dave Letterman. Did that come from Creation Nation in some way?
Was a total random audition that I was sent out on, and I booked it. And it was, I played Daryl, the Late Show page with a fake British accent, which I guess was a bit that Dave did back when he was on NBC before this. I was on the show when he was on, obviously, at CBS. And so it's just like this page comes out and like – talks like this with the fat, you know, it's like, I ate some chips and took a lift to the flat and, you know, but it's super exaggerated and stupid. And then I just like tell, you know, I call Dave like a tosser and then like, something like that.
Bad British accented word, every bad British.
I called him Dive, like D-I-V-E. It was So silly. God. But yeah, I got to do that twice. I went three times, and it was the kind of thing where they put it in the show if there was time. And so the first time I went, there was time. So I made it to the show, which was awesome. And then the second time, I think I was like sort of waiting around, and then they cut my bit. And then they brought me back like a couple months later, maybe a year later, to do it again. And that was my last time, because it was like there was some sports thing happening, and
like the World Series
was,
or something.
Yeah, it was like the World Series or something. I don't know. And so like I believe it was Dave, like, had gone. I was given the script, and so I learned it up and down, left and right. I knew what I was going to do. And then about 20 minutes before we go to tape, I get rewrites, and I think it was from Dave himself, like about like sports. And it just knocked me off my game. And I don't know, like, I was like wearing these like baggy khakis, so you can't really tell, but like inside the pant legs, my knees were like shaking so hard. I was like vibrating. It was so scary, because you're talking and it's like not even a bit. It's not like a bit that I'm having with, you know,
with
anyone else, like Alan, or, you know, it was like a bit with Dave, like looking at him across the stage, like crazy.
About sports, no less. Why couldn't about it be about sports. Musicals?
I mean, of course. And then they never had me back. like no. Yeah.
I love that. It. From Schmoozy to Daryl.
To Schmoozy to Daryl, yes.
What a exactly. Gamut in those early years. All right, it's dream time. It's where you tell me if you could be in any show, anywhere, at any time, what would it be?
I mean, I'm sure you've gotten this before, but it would be Angels in America. Mm. It's like, yeah. That also, like, that was very influential on me too, because it came out as I was like, you know, about to graduate from high school. And, I like the story too. I did theater camp when I was in high school.
Obviously.
and obviously. and over the summer. And so the summer after graduating from high school, before I went to Northwestern, I did theater camp at the University of Iowa. And so we did like it's like a couple of weeks, and then like at the end you do like a scene study, and you do a scene, and you invite everybody to come and watch. And our teacher, what kind of person I was gonna grow up to be, and she gave me this other girl the Harper and Joe scene. Mm. It's the I Burn Dinner scene.
Yeah,
and and it was just like, and I performed it in front of my mom and my sister, and it was the first time where I felt that visceral connection between myself and the work. If that makes any sense. Like I had done like plays, but this hit differently. It rocked my world. And like, you know, and again, it was like, and I, like I said before, like this was like the summer before I was like, this is what I was gunning for. You know, I was like, once I get to Northwestern, I'm going to come out of the closet. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to have a boyfriend, you know, and this is like the summer right before that. And yeah, that brilliant teacher, wherever she may be, thank you, because she gave me this scene, and I had never read Angels before. And so, you know, it just cracked the whole, it just made like, I was like, this is what I'm meant to be doing. You know, like this feels right. And amazing. So yeah. And I would play any role. I would, honestly, I would love to play Pryor, Joe, Roy, any of them. I mean,
you'd be great. You'd be a great Pryor, actually.
Oh, that's like one of the nicest things anyone could say to me, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Like,
you have it in you. And that's why I made that joke when we started about how your TV roles have scared me. So, you know, with Will Bettelheim, I mean, I'm obsessed with you, and certainly Oswald Cobblepot, and, you know, it's, but if you know you, you're there's so much depth and beauty and pain and realness and authenticity. And so, you know, I can see you as Pryor, and we have to talk about we have to talk about Oswald just for a minute, you know,
yes,
that journey, which obviously really put you on the map and made your career. Did you find in developing the character in growing up, you know, over the seasons in that role, did you pull from any particular roles from earlier in your life or inspirations or, mentors or anything?
I would love to say that, like, one of my biggest inspirations for the character would be Sally Field's performance as Celeste Talbot in Soap Dish. Wow. I don't know if you've seen Soap Dish in a while, but Sally Field is such a huge influence on my acting. And like, there are so many, like when Oswald would get like really mad and snap at people, like I was just, I could feel myself channeling Sally Field in those moments. So it sounds so silly to say that, but yeah, like that was definitely a huge influence on me. But more than that also, I was also hugely influenced by Heath Ledger. Because I like that Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker. Heath Ledger's role in the Batman movie was so influential to me, only because it was the first time that I'd really seen, you know, a true arch villain, but with underneath all of that anger and violence. Was a damaged human. Like there's empathy there. There's something deep down in there that if things had gone differently, this person would be, this person very well wouldn't be a villain, wouldn't be the evil person. And so seeing that performance, and then when I got cast as the Penguin, I was like, I really, really want to bring that to this character as well, because that's something that you can sustain and also sustain like a connection to the audience. It's really hard to sustain, especially over 5 years, like an evil character that is just, you know, it's just purely bad. You know what I mean? Yeah. What's interesting to me is finding the human being, especially like in a comic book world or in a fantastic world, like finding a real human being underneath there. And also like finding, like, I do believe that, you know, everyone is innately good. So I really wanted to bring that to light with him and just, you know, make a sympathetic, like, anti-hero, you know, like, and it was definitely Heath Ledger's performance that influenced me to that.
That's amazing. Yeah. And you did that. You did all of that with that role. There is a surprise section of the show, which we don't tell our guests about, which is a lightning round.
Ooh, okay.
And because from a scale of 1 to 10, you are a musical aficionado of an 8, we're going to go with the what show are these lyrics from?
Oh, God. Okay. All right. Okay.
You know, lyrics are the most emotionally impactful piece of musicals. And so because this is all about nostalgia and emotionality with shows, we're gonna touch upon the most emoting ones.
And right, Eva, I mean, you and I are contemporaries. Like when you got this original soundtrack CD, sometimes it was that double CD case, you know, and then it had that thick book like right in the middle that
every lyric
was, that was the first thing you did was open that up and start singing along. I mean, that,
of course.
That was like my entire childhood.
Was my entire childhood. Spent a lot of time alone listening to show tunes.
Oops. Oh gosh.
All right. 30 seconds on the clock. Well, someone tell me, when is it my turn? Don't I get a dream for myself?
It's gonna be my turn.
Turn.
Get a world, get off my runway. Rose's turn from Gypsy.
What show? Yes.
Gypsy, yes.
Somebody crowd me with love. Somebody
force me to care. Being Alive Company.
Yes. I am unworthy of your love.
Charlie Darling. That would be Assassins. Thank you.
Everybody loves a winner.
Wait, Assassins. Is it I am unworthy of your love?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. You that's just need the song? Show. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Unworthy of your love.
Yeah. But the show is all you need. Everybody loves a winner, so nobody loves me. Lady peaceful.
Lady
happy.
Lady Happy. Sooner. Wait, no. That's what I want to say. It's Cabaret.
Yes.
Maybe
you just
this
need the show. You just need, you're getting extra credit, I which extra I appreciate. You win. You win.
Is that it?
You got, that's it. We're out of time. You got every lyric. You
nothing
got
promises. Nothing from A Little Night Music. I mean, even.
I mean, how much Sondheim can I do in one section of one podcast? I mean, I obviously have A Little Night Music here.
He's been posting on Instagram. I don't know if you've seen this. Like, if you don't follow Stephen Sondheim, anyone out there, well, get on there. It's on Instagram. It's the most wholesome thing. Yeah.
Anyway. The answer to all of life's problems is in a Sondheim lyric.
It sincerely is. Oh, it is, my God.
It is,
I miss it so much.
I adore you, Robin,
I love
Lord
you so
Taylor.
Much,
I love you. I'm so proud of the human you are and the artist that you are, and keep on it all.
Thank you so much, Eva. And you too. And yeah, and oh, can I give a little plug too?
Please.
I want to give a plug to beanartshero.org. It's a foundation where, they're helping lobby for all of us out there who can't go back to work because of the shuttering of Broadway or the closing of music venues. Beanartshero.org. If you guys check that out, that would be awesome.
Hello, 12.
Hello, 13.
Hello, love.
Change is old.
Down below.
Up above.
My First Show is produced by Josh Altman, MEP, Dori Berenstein, and Alan Seals, and is part of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was edited by Derek Gunther. Special thanks to Leslie Papa and Whitney Holden-Gore at Vivacity Media Group. For more info about the podcast, visit bpn.fm/myfirstshow. Follow me on Instagram at Eva R. Price.
I am not certain of. Hello, 12. Hello, 13. Hello.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.